This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Patchwork Nation is a reporting project designed to explore the U.S. demographically by dividing the nation's 3,141 counties into 12 community types based on income level, racial composition, employment, and religion. Launched as a Christian Science Monitor project by Dante Cini and James Gimple to cover the 2008 election, it was done in collaboration with the PBS NewsHour, WNYC, Politico, and the Knight Foundation, and has resulted in a book called Our Patchwork Nation, The Surprising Truth About the Real America, by Dante Cini and James Gimple. Dante Cini's work has appeared in Newsweek, The New Republic, and The Washington Post magazine, and he joins us in studio for this forum segment. Welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here. Well, I think probably one of the things that gets you and your partner in this project most burned up is the idea that we're divided into red and blue states. I mean, this really, in many ways, was a catalyst to sort of disabuse us of this stereotype.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's not that red and blue, and we say this in the book, it's not that red and blue are completely worthless. I mean, every 4 years, every 2 years, as we're going through right now, you have elections. And, you know, ultimately, really, when you get down to it, there's two real options on the ballot. They're represented by two colors, red and blue, and then we decide who controls Congress or who wins the presidency through that, and it's fine. The problem is that we've taken this red and blue breakdown and expanded it to say that there's a red America and blue America, and that they're two different Americas living within the country, and that's it. And what you know, as a reporter, you go out there and you realize, you know, red America is Orange County, and red America is the middle of Nebraska. And those two places have very little in common beyond the fact that they vote Republican. I mean, so when we did this, the idea was, let's get beyond, you know, how people vote and look at why people vote the way they do. That was how we started it.
Did you start with the notion that there are many Americas, that there's all this pluralism of different communities spread out regionally throughout the U.S.?
Yeah, absolutely. I think as a reporter, you go to different places around the country and you land someplace and you drive for a while and you get out and you're like, wow, this place in, you know, Tennessee might be in the South, but it really reminds me of this place up in Minnesota. I mean, people talk differently, but, you know, there are a lot of similarities here. And that was one of the ideas behind the project. Let's find some way to use numbers to quantify that and then still put real reporting behind it.
In fact, one of the most fascinating things about this is where you can find, say, a Walmart's as opposed to a Starbucks.
Right.
I mean, the marketing sort of searches these things out. What do you mean by the real America? You know, people talk about, you know, well, if it'll play in Peoria, and you kind of, again, disabuse us of that notion. So
Right. The
real America is these 12 is a good number, disciples and all that, 12?
Yeah, we just worked out. We weren't doing it for biblical reference, but yeah. Well, you know, the point is that there is no real America. You know, the real America, which we hear about particularly every 4 years, it seems like when we have a presidential campaign, and politicians try to play two different Americas and talk about which one is real and which one isn't. You know, what we're trying to get at in the book is, you know, San Francisco is just as real as Sioux Center, Iowa, which is a place I go, and it's just as real as Ann Arbor, Michigan, and it's just as real as Hopkinsville, Kentucky. These are all places, I mean, I'm visiting here, but the other places I go to talk to people, they're just different. There is no right America. They're just all different places with different economies, different cultures.
They're unique, but as you say in your book, if you think you're alone, you may be wrong, because there may be a community very much like the community you're living in, but not necessarily even within propinquity, to use a word that I probably shouldn't use on the air.
Huh? I saw this. I mean, when I did this project, it's really interesting. One of the places I went was a town called Lincoln City, Oregon, which is on the coast up in Oregon. And when I went there and I drove down the street, I mean, obviously, there are mountains up there, but driving down the main street in Lincoln City, Oregon, I was completely transported back to being a kid. And
you grew up in Michigan.
Exactly, yeah. And going to the west side of Michigan by Lake Michigan, a little town called Ludington. And I was just like, oh, my God, this is Ludington. This is Ludington on the West Coast. I mean, it's Ludington with better coffee. But I mean, it's the same kind of place. And I think that's something we've really been able to tap into with the book.
And you feel that perhaps only about 5% is not tappable, so to speak.
Yeah, and you know, when you really break down the numbers, some places are obviously better fits than others. But there are about 5% of the counties, and actually we're in one of them right now, that are very hard to classify as any one thing. San Francisco is a truly unique place. We end up classifying as a moneyed burb. And that's despite the fact that it has such diversity, just because there's such wealth here. You know, household income here is higher than Manhattan. I mean, this is a very wealthy area, very well-educated area. And we ended up placing it into that category. There are about 5% of the counties in the U.S. that are really hard to place.
Well, L.A. County.
L.A.
Has so much crossover that, yeah.
Very difficult. I mean, is L.A., you know, is L.A. a boom town because of the way it grows, which is a category we have? Is it immigration nation because of its high Latino population? We made it an industrial metropolis just because the one thing it really does have is immense diversity and really real differences in terms of income levels and things like that.
Well, let's look at these categories, and then we'll bring our listeners in and get their responses. You mentioned boom towns and immigration centers. Those, I guess, are fairly self-explanatory, just
right.
Like military bastions and evangelical epicenters.
Right.
Emptying nests?
Emptying nests are kind of – these places aren't – we say emptying. They're not empty yet. But it's full of people 50, a lot of people 50 and over, and that really has an impact on what those places feel like. I mean, the place I go for that is Claremont, Florida. And I, you know, for all these types, I had one real place that I've basically been going to for 2.5 years.
But you think of Sun City in Arizona.
Absolutely. And actually, I go by Sun City to one of the other places I go. But it's Sun City is a perfect example. And it's a lot like Claremont without the humidity.
And then again, campus and careers, taking you back to Michigan, a place like Ann Arbor.
Yep.
Industrial metropolis and military bastions, these, again, are fairly self-explanatory. In fact, Hopkinsville, Kentucky is a good example of the military bastion that you alluded to
before. Yeah.
Minority Central.
Yeah, this was a category that is primarily large counties of high African-American populations, and they tend to be lower income, lower education levels. However, Minority Central also, we included some counties out west that have large Native American populations. And at first you might think, well, that doesn't make any sense. But there are actually a lot of similarities in terms of the cultures of those places, in terms of the tensions that exist between the different populations that live there, and a lot of the same problems in terms of income, education, things like that.
Minority Central has 364 of the counties, which means 13.5 million people. Then you mentioned the moneyed burbs, 286 counties with 69.1 million people.
Yep.
And Mormon outposts, surprisingly, 44 counties, 1.7 million people.
We added the Mormon outposts. We originally didn't have them. We originally did this – when we crunched all these numbers, I mean, you could have 50 different types. We said, look, this is a journalistic enterprise. It has to be understandable. Let's keep it between 10 and 15 types. And then you kind of group counties that way. We originally had 11. We added 12 because originally a lot of these Mormon outposts we placed into the evangelical epicenter category because they had a lot of the same very conservative, strong religious
Never
background.
Never confuse Mormons with evangelicals.
That's exactly
burn
right.
You at the stake.
That's exactly right. And those places really feel different. Those Mormon outposts, one religion really grounds the entire place, affects everything, affects the politics, affects the culture. Very different from the evangelical epicenters I go to.
Then we'll round this out with service worker centers and tractor country.
Yeah, service worker centers are small town America without the agriculture. That's Lincoln City, Oregon. This place where we all trade money. You own the hardware store. I own the gas station. And tractor country is big, the kind of big, empty middle part of America where there are more cows or pigs than people.
So how does this help us with predicting elections, engaging what voter responses are going to be? I heard a talk that David Brooks gave recently, and you know he was saying there's a kind of expertise now that can tell you, you know, in terms of voting sections of the country, well, in this particular county, this family moved out. So
right, exactly. I mean,
that kind of specific detail. Now, here you've got these 12 regions and 12 types of communities, 12 archetypes almost, really.
Right, right, right.
And how does that help us understand elections?
Well, I think it helps us understand elections. That was why we started doing this, because the one thing we wanted to get at was why people voted the way they do. So you go to some of these places and you realize that, you know, tractor country is very socially conservative, but also just the issues they pay attention to are different. So you come down to – you wouldn't expect immigration to be a big issue in tractor country. It is. You know, you go to places like the military bastions. What's driving things there? Well – what do you think? I mean, it's Afghanistan, Iraq. These things are big issues. And those places are really torn in terms of how they feel about having their boys and girls deployed and they're the kind of patriotic sentiment that really runs through those places. What we think it does, though, even more than being predictive, because it's hard to be predictive, especially with what's happening in the country right now, is it does help you understand just how complicated the United States is and why. You know, the one thing that really came clear to me as I did this project and working with Jim, the professor at Maryland, is it's amazing we can get anything accomplished in this country because, you know, the motivating factors of these different places are so different. And it's – you really do understand why governing the United States is really it's not impossible, but it's extremely difficult.
It's almost miraculous that it does get governed.
Absolutely, at all. Yeah.
Again, we're talking to Dante Cini. His new book, co-authored with James Gimple, is called Our Patchwork Nation, The Surprising Truth About the Real America, the 12 Community Types That Make Up Our Nation. I'd like to get you, the listeners, involved in this and your response to this way of seeing America. I mean, as pluralistic and as, well, extraordinarily fluid as American identity is, it does raise some fascinating questions about how people vote and why they vote. And you're welcome to join the conversation. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. So please feel free to join us now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. I'd love to hear from you. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also send us an email, forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment in response on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. Pretty much stand behind these as being representative places, these communities, these, I think at one point you call socio-cultural ant farms.
Yeah, they really are. Particularly the places that we went. I mean, the places we picked, we crunched all these numbers, so we knew the places we went were perfect, kind of or very close to perfect representations of the archetypes that we'd identified. And, you know, now not every place falls completely in. You know, not every tract of country community is going to look just like Sioux Center, Iowa, but there are going to be a lot of similarities. A lot of similarities.
But you think about just the regional differences. Mm-hmm. You know, the Mason-Dixon line, mm-hmm. and how, I mean, Southern culture is a very different culture. It's another nation with another history, if you choose to see it as such. It was defeated, as opposed to, you know, American ethos of always
right.
being victorious and so forth. And we've had Southern presidents. Jimmy Carter comes quickly to mind, of course. And,
right.
And yet the South has always had this very distinct identity. So yet you're making intersection lines between Southern community
right.
and way up North communities.
Yeah, because when you really get right down to it, it's true. What you're saying is true. But, you know, look at, for instance, at Georgia. I mean, Atlanta is a very different place than Athens. You know, those are very different communities.
Athens, Greece, or Athens, Ohio? Athens, Georgia.
Athens, Georgia, not Athens, Ohio, and certainly not Athens, Greece. I mean, you know, when you're around a college town, there is a certain atmosphere and a culture that pervades. And obviously, the big city that is Atlanta is very different from the suburbs around it, and obviously very different from when you get it kind of into the hinterlands of Georgia, which are a lot of minority central communities out there and a lot of evangelical epicenters out there. Very different places. You know, the minority central communities, a lot of times you have a strong divide between black and white in those places, and the vote often looks split along those lines. Talk about politics again. But then you go to an evangelical epicenter, it can be like a place next door, even they can be counties next door to each other, and maybe the African American population is much smaller. The vote looks very different. I mean, I grew up in Michigan again. Washtenaw County, where Ann Arbor is, borders Wayne County, where Detroit is. Both those places are liberal in terms of the way they vote, but you'd be hard pressed to find two places that are more dissimilar than Ann Arbor and Detroit,
Michigan. Not only Ann Arbor and Detroit, but you go say from Bloomfield Hills into
Absolutely.
The heart of the urban area of Detroit, and
yeah.
you're two sides of the moon.
Yeah, and you're not really. What are you? You know, you're 10 miles away, and it's a whole different world. Whole different world.
Let's find out what our listeners have to say, and we'll go first to you, Brian. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Good morning. I just wanted to find out, in your studies, these areas that had high immigrant populations, what do you find is driving their voting or moral stances for America or the America they see in the future? You know, if they're coming from another country that's maybe disstable or whatever,
mm-hmm.
How do they become American and start thinking like, what do I want America to look like in the future for my family?
That's a good question. The community I go to look at immigration nation, as we define it, is a town called El Mirage, which is part of Maricopa County. And the Latinos there, they are, you know, there's been a lot said about how they're socially conservative, and they are. They do tend to be socially conservative. But, you know, obviously the thing driving their vote right now is something very different. It's about how they're being treated as citizens. You know, and this isn't just true in Maricopa County, where you have Joe Arpaio, who is a very interesting character. I spent some time, and I had a nice long interview with Sheriff Joe, and he's really a character. But the community and the way they respond to him is when there's a sheriff's cruiser in El Mirage, there's an informal phone tree that basically says, and this is for legal immigrants as well, who call each other and say, stay away from the street, There's a sheriff's cruiser there. They're going to harass you. You know, and in a way, those people are almost, it's, you don't want to say a police state, but it's a state within a state. And that's motivating their vote right now. Depending on what happens with the immigration battles in this country, I don't know what their vote's going to look like in the future. There are really, those places tend to be a really interesting mix because, first of all, you have the Anglo vote there, which actually tends to be Republican often, in part because they're sharply set against the immigration, the immigrant population there. But then, you know, the Latino populations in those places, you know, they do tend to be socially conservative.
Let me thank the caller, and we'll move on to more of your calls. We'll go to Andy next. Andy, join us. Morning.
Yeah, thank you. I have two questions that I think are pretty related. On one side, I'd like to get a sense of how homogeneous you're finding things within these different areas that you're looking at in the U.S. And on the other side, I'm wondering if a study like this has ever been done in other countries, and is the U.S. really a more varied place than other countries, either similar places, other, you know, advanced industrial countries, or places where, you know, the city-country difference is really big?
Well, that's the first question. I was just thinking when you were talking about Atlanta, there is a kind of homogeneity to the big cities of America, isn't there?
Really is, yeah.
I'm not talking about fast food and all that, but the airports and just the dress and everything, really.
The way I think about it is, as reporters, a lot of times, you spend your time flying often between kind of suburban areas, and you fly from, say, Washington to St. Louis, and you get off the plane and you drive through suburban St. Louis, like, oh my gosh, I feel like I'm at home. Like, there's the Pottery Barn and there's the Starbucks. It's very comforting to me.
Good to be comforted on the road when you're a reporter.
Yeah. But when you get out, it really changes.
Do you know if there's been a study abroad like this?
No, and I don't know that. That's a great question. I would tend to think that there are differences, I think, between city folk and country folk everywhere you go. The United States is, I think, unique in some ways just because of the way the country formed. I mean, everybody here is from – most people here are from someplace else, and their ancestors are from someplace else. And we're many different races, and we don't share a common religion. We don't share a common history besides the U.S. history, but I mean our cultural history, our individual cultural histories. And I think, you know, increasingly we don't really share a common language. So the U.S. is kind of, I think a place like China, you might see some real differences. But, you know, a big, complicated country like the U.S., I don't know. I'd really be curious to see. I hope somebody has done a study like that, and thank you for the caller, because I want to look that up now.
Thank you, Andy. And we'll go to another caller, and Mike is joining us from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Good morning.
Hey, thank you so much. Great topic. And spent most of my adult life in the military, lived all over the country, and seen a lot of this firsthand. I voted in California, Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina. But one question I have is, I think there's a change afoot in the sense that the virtual revolution is tying disparate voters together, not just, say, Republicans or Democrats from different parts of the country, voting in the same party for different reasons, but also folks that would politically be opposed joining forces more readily to oppose a common issue or to support a common issue. And I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your call.
You know, that's something we look at in the book. We have a chapter just on culture, because there is this assumption, I think, that what's happened technologically has made us more homogeneous. I can be in the middle of nowhere in Nebraska, and provided I have a good connection, I can read the New York Times, right? And that's wonderful for me if I like to read the New York Times. But, you know, but the fact of the matter is, most people don't do that. You know, most people in rural Nebraska don't read the New York Times, and it's because they're just not as interested in it. The news in there, they're much more interested about what happens closer to home for them, and they're much more interested about the issues that affect them. And
like you say in the book, there are some areas that are more interested in what the high school football team is doing than
absolutely
what's
well,
going
especially
on in the world,
yeah. Especially than the New York Giants, you know. But the what's happened with technology is, it's true that you can bring, and we say this in the book, you can bring your own bubble with you wherever you go. You can have your media with you, and you can read your hometown paper wherever you are on your wireless device. But what's really happened with the internet is there are more channels than ever, really. I mean, there was a time when wherever you went, you had ABC, NBC, and CBS, and that's what you're going to watch on TV. You travel now, and you have 50, 60, 70 channels options. I mean, even in, you know, Sioux Center, Iowa. And they're different. You know, they get different channels in Sioux Center, Iowa on their basic cable than they get in Philadelphia. There is no BET available in Sioux Center, Iowa. I guarantee you, because I've been there. So what's really happened with the technological revolution is there are more channels than ever, and that allows for more niching, actually. So, you know, even though you can kind of go whatever path you want to go on now, more than you ever could.
Here's some questions from listeners via email. Alan says, the author tries to explain how people vote and why they vote, but does the book explain why people don't vote? Are there differing reasons?
We don't get into that in the book. You know, the biggest reason people don't vote, honestly, is apathy. And we say at the end of the book, that's honestly, that tends to be a sign. It's not really a lot of times throwing up your hands and being pox on the entire system. It's more just, you know, things are generally okay. I'm not as interested in voting.
Another listener, David in Berkeley, says, you seem to be describing geography and locations. Do your types apply to individuals?
Well, we try in this – what we're talking about in the book is we really are talking about communities and rather than individuals. And the reason we do that is we spend a lot of time every election talking about these demographic slices. Then we talk about soccer moms or we talk about NASCAR dads. And the problem with that is that I think, and Jim thinks, the professor who crunches the numbers on this, a soccer mom, whatever that is, in rural rural Texas is different than a soccer mom in suburban New York. They experience, I mean, their realities are just different. Their economies are different. You know, their cultures are different. The way I think about it is this: you could be the most Republican person in America, but if you live in New York and maybe you'd fall into like super right winger if you're slicing the demographics that way. But you know, if you live in New York City, it's going to be hard for you to be opposed to mass transit funding, right? I mean, because that's your reality. Your reality is, good God, if we don't have this subway, nobody's going to be able to get around the city. And that affects it, – it's just your everyday experiences affect the way you see the world.
It's fascinating how there's almost a tropism in America to try to homogenize, I guess, is the right word that I'm thinking of. I mean, I remember Susan Sontag saying something about how Americans tend to say things operate in decades. Like I'm a kid of the 60s, and therefore I was shaped by the 60s. Well, you know, there were so many different classes of people that weren't shaped by the 60s and didn't find themselves associated with a movement or protests against Vietnam or any of those kinds of things. So it's this wide panoply, really, that we're talking about and that you're talking about. And I think, you know, this is useful. Frank writes, can your guest name, this goes right to the point, three factors which are similar and or unite the different areas?
You know, we talk about this a little bit at the end of the book. It's a little, I'll tell you, you do this for 2.5 years and you honestly get a little depressed about how the heck can we govern the country? What do all these places share other than, you know, maybe they watch football on Sunday, which, you know, think, you know, God bless the NFL, right? Or something like that. But, you know, the thing that does really tie all these places together when we crunch the numbers, because they look really different on everything from how they feel about gay marriage to how they feel about immigration, the numbers really tell.
Glenn Beck versus NPR.
Absolutely, there is some of that. It's not necessarily the way it falls. Doesn't necessarily fall out the way you think it does, but those differences are really there. The one thing that does unite all these types, and it's kind of a startling number actually, is more than 66% or more than everybody that lives in all these communities, when we crunch the numbers, still has a very positive view of you can make what you want of yourself in America. This, the idea that if I work hard, I can get ahead, is a belief that is really shared across all these different community types. It is the one kind of that American optimism still exists. I'm curious to see 5 years from now.
Well, if this economy continues on this downslide, I mean, some of this is just so embedded in the culture,
exactly,
and its ethos, and Horatio Alger, and you know, the ideals of America.
Yet there is this feeling now when I go and talk to people in these places that things are out of their control now. I mean, Americans want to believe they control their own destiny, and I hate saying Americans too because, believe me, they're very different. But I do think that's so much a part of the American mythology. But when I go talk to people, particularly people in places that are really hurting, that's taken a hit. It really has taken a hit. And they feel they're somehow, you know, at the whims of some larger force that they can't control. They really do feel that. And I don't think that's completely irrational for them to think that.
Let's bring on our next caller. Mikhail, good morning.
Hello. Thank you. Yes. I would like to know from the guest whether he thinks that there are broad regions of the left and right in significant numbers to be significant politically, that agree on some broad issues. For instance, would you say that in some realms of the country, in large numbers, both left and right agree that election reform in some form is necessary? or are there other issues also that that they could agree on and so forth? Can you give me some idea? I'm looking for some hope here. Thank you.
So I think we're all looking for hope right now. I think that, honestly, those things are few and far between. And it's for this reason. You go to some places around the country, and the doldrums there are really driven by the fact that everybody's house is worth 40% less than it was a couple of years ago. And you go to other places in the country, and the doldrums there are driven by the fact that nobody can get a job. And you go to other parts of the country, and the doldrums there are driven by some third factor. So now, I think you could get broad agreement on something like we should reduce the national deficit and the national debt. But, you know, you could get broad agreement on that. But then you've got to get, okay, well, how do we do that? Then it gets a lot more complicated because things like balancing the budget, this is what we're going to see too in this next election. You know, this anger that's risen and says we have to have change. I think a lot of people feel we have to have change. But what kind of change? You know, just standing up and saying everything has to change is one thing. Making the change is completely different because the change through the eyes of what's needed in tractor country is really different from the change through the eyes of what's needed for somebody, say, in the boom towns or just generally what the problems are there.
Let me try to get on a final caller. Kevin, that's you. Welcome.
Yeah, us erudite Bay Area people have a hard time comprehending the local yokels who put Bush into office and support Glenn Beck. And it's hard to understand how they might support a complete idiot who has no business running for president like Sarah Palin. And these are all the red state people and everything else. Could you explain what, are these people just stupid?
I think I really would suggest, look, I live in Washington, D.C., in the city. I have my own personal views about everything, obviously. But when I did this book, and it's just when I'm a reporter, I really try to go out and understand where these people are coming from, different people. And I'm not saying those people, just all these different places I go. And, you know, the fact of the matter is for some people, Sarah Palin makes sense to them because she's like them. And they think that's what the president
should be. I think that's the key. I remember when Roman Ruska was nominated and Nixon said defended him because people were saying he's the essence of mediocrity. And Nixon said, well, there are plenty of people who are mediocre.
There
they
has
want
to be a
mediocre
voice.
Person.
There has to be a voice for mediocrity. Exactly.
Dante Cheney, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
And you can meet the author of Patchwork Nation tonight. He'll be at UC Berkeley's J School at 7 o'clock. Again, the book is Patchwork Nation, The Surprising Truth About the Real America. We thank him for being with us. We thank you for being with us. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks also to Senior Editor Dan Zoll, to our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.